Pacino speaks of the two Aphrodites and the two Venuses as demoniacs, that they are demons in the soul, through sign language. They are powers that are there. I mean, that's interesting language.
But that's not pejorative, is it, to talk about them as demoniacs? Yeah.
Say again that it's...
Did you mean to suggest that that's somehow pejorative?
Well, I thought it was interesting. Not at all. I mean, it seems to me that post-enlightenment, I mean, the idea of angels and demons is somewhat puzzling to us. But, I mean, for him, this is real. I mean, that a demon is a very interesting kind of entity because they have desires, like mortals, as Augustine defines demons in the City of God, in a very extensive passage, but he says that basically it boils down to the fact that demons have desires and wants like mortals, but they're immortal like the gods. And this is a very dangerous combination. And they dwell in the airy regions, you know, between heaven and earth. They're potential mediators in a certain sense, and dangerous ones. But it's interesting it seems interesting, and maybe there's a question there to pursue, that, you know, why would Ficino speak of the two Aphrodites? This is, I mean, that's not in the Symposium of Plato, speaking of the two Aphrodites as demons, and it's an interesting development, if you like, of the argument. But I wondered whether maybe anybody had any thoughts.
Why is the heavenly Aphrodite a demon too, if demons are so dangerous? Because isn't the heavenly Aphrodite the one that's going to bring you upwards?
Well, it was... Again, you have to remember. There's a lot of space, in philosophical history between Ficino and Plotinus and certainly Plato. And part of that history involves, of course, Orthodox Christianity. And for the Christians, the pagan divinities were sometimes regarded as demons and spoken of as demons. It's not that they didn't exist, but it's just that they were inferior. Jumped up divinities who, you might say, claimed people's allegiance, but that they might be satisfied with them, when in fact the only kind of divinity that ought to satisfy them ought to be the one, rather than some intermediate being. But nonetheless, that to speak of a classical divinity as a demon would be a commonplace.
I can't remember where I saw it now, but in the set text, he also equates ancient divinities with angels.
Yes.
Yeah, that was my... I thought the syncretizing might have been...
Presumably because of what you said.
Well, each planet. And he talks about the Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars, and so on, going back to Aristotle, the traditional view was that each heavenly body had its mover. Mm. And the mover was... it was a motor spirit. And it was like a soul in that sense. So... giving life and motion to this otherwise inert body. So in some sense, thinking about the operation of the heavenly motions is also, you might say, close to a question of how souls operate. So that we can give an account for the motion of the heavens would depend on their having some moving cause. And we give the names of these divinities to them, so that they are angelic spirits.
Yeah, which might explain why the heavenly Aphrodite can still be akin to an angel, you know, as a means of getting you there. Mm-hmm. As you're saying, their intermediate role.
Yeah, I mean, this is more of a curiosity, but it's a follow-up of what you were saying. There is an old book, I think it's a still inspired one, by Walker. It's like a natural and demonic magic from Ficino to Campanella. And Walker studies very well sort of like Ficino's demonology, also like his angelology. And the role that sort of like intermediary entities play in the process of both sort of like a transformation of the operator, so there is the idea of the magus who endures a process of change, and also like how by the intercession of angels or demons, sort of like an operator can do things. And you mentioned Plotinus, that's excellent. It shouldn't be forgotten that Ficino is also like an attentive reader of Proclus. He actually entitled his masterpiece Platonic Theology, so it's sort of like in the tradition of Proclus. And the Proclus hymns, for example, is Proclus prayers, The Ficino translated on the, some of these contemporaries imitated are precisely invocation addressed to sort of like all the gods from pagan temples that are meant to sort of like trigger epistrophe, sort of like this turning of the soul of the praying subject toward the contemplation of the one, etc.
But is it a flight from the body? See, this is, there's a big question I think lurking all around here. Is Ficino really simply returning to a pagan metaphysics? Is he, by which one might mean more concretely, that he thinks that conversion is a kind of a flight from the body, a freeing oneself of the prison house of the body? Or is there something, is there an emphasis here that might have a more Christian aspect to it? I mean, is there any hint, say, of a resurrected body, a kind of stabilized condition of soul and body, which seems to be more characteristic of an explicitly Christian metaphysic? I mean, it seems to me that if you're going to, you know, arraign Ficino for heresy, it might be that he's you know, he's some kind of neo-pagan, and this is a dangerous thing. And there was a whole community, by the way, of Benedictines in Florence, the Camaldolese monks of Santa Maria degli Angeli, appropriately named House, who devoted themselves to Platonic dialogue, and this went on for decades. That these monks thought that rather than committing themselves to traditional monastic studies, that they would do the Platonic thing. And I mean, that would be an example of a community that basically converted itself to a practice modeled on something like what Ficino's talking about. And the only reason I raise that example, I have a student actually written a thesis on this, Ambrogio Traversari is sort of the key figure in this, is that it seems to raise the possibility that there were people who thought that they could reconcile Ficino's metaphysics with a fairly, orthodox understanding of a religious Christian life. These Benedictines thought they could. And that sort of raises the question, well, how could they possibly think such a thing? I mean, is this not simply a return to a metaphysic of I mean, clearly it seems to me Plotinus, it's about flight from the body, that prison house. But I'm not sure that it is for Ficino.
There is the issue of desire, no, that you were discussing earlier.
Yeah.
On how desire fits into the equation. I don't know whether Ficino really is able to solve that equation. It seems to me that some of the later mystics, Saint John of the Cross, and these kind of mystics are able to incorporate many of the things that are present in Neoplatonism about the idea of moving yourself without being moved and getting into connection with the absolute, and at the same time negotiate the whole erotic of the absolute that Ficino seems a little bit talking about. But perhaps Ficino, and that is why I don't know, in speaking of conversions, whether it's kind of a intermediate point in the development of a certain form of religious expression in the early modern period, that is going towards that spiritualism of the Counter-Reformation, So part of that is
Luther as well, maybe.
I mean, it does seem to me that you're right about this, and that conversion for Ficino, and this is based on just what I've read here in the discussion we've had so far, and the stuff I read a long time ago, is a form of sublimation of desire, and a transformation of desire into a state of unity with God. The sublimation is expressed as a movement from movement to stillness. But once desire becomes a kind of instrument that is sublimated in the conversion of the soul, it's hard to get away from it. It keeps coming back. And I think it's that that makes these texts so interesting, is that there seems to be some kind of return to pre-Augustinian sense of the difference between the material world and the spiritual world. That seemed fairly straightforward and very un-Christian. But that cannot be that can't be accomplished. Both because, you know, there's partly because the beauty of the world, there's, you know, all of that stuff about beauty and the grace that that shines through the physical beauty, and also because if desire is so important for his thinking, he can't ever get away from desire as something that belongs to the material physical world. It can't ever be fully transformed.
But yeah.
Well, it's interesting because that these were the questions that I had when I was reading it, and because in that letter, I think it's letter 25, one of the letters, where he talks about, you know, can the soul function, continue to function without the body, and can, you know, can it still, and basically he says that it can function even better without the body, because then the body is a limit. But then that seems kind of contradictory, or not necessarily, but I mean, it's kind of difficult to kind of unite that with what's written in the text, and this, I mean, then the desire, you know, is the desire then separated from the body? I mean, I don't know.
I ask, are you returning to Torrance's point about, is this finally Christian, or
what is immortality about? I take it as the question. I mean, there's this, there are all sorts of ways into this question, but it was very interesting to me that he seemed to take sides with Aristotle about the generation of the soul. That the soul comes to be when, in some sense, the body is in gestation. That is, that there's the, you know, quickening, Kathleen Austin's thesis, that ensoulment seems to be necessarily tied to a body, as it were, being formed in the womb. Whereas there's this other view, which he seems to distance himself from, and is that there are, you know, the souls are these stars, these eternal entities that have always been there, and that they're always somehow associated, and then they come to be tied to body, but he seems to be, there seems to be a kind of an Aristotelian and somewhat Thomist view working in Ficino there when he takes the position that soul is really, on that view, as Aquinas says, the actuality of the body with the life potential in it. That the idea of an abstracted soul having a being independent of that seems to be something he's wary about. So I'm just, I mean, that's tied, I think, to this question of how he conceives immortality, that it's not, I don't think he's perhaps quite as negative on body, perhaps, as some of the Platonists are. Or at least he seems to be leaning in the direction of Aristotle on that one.
Yeah, also what's crucial in light of what you just said is one of your points of interest, which is about sexuality, homosexuality, because when he has that discussion in speech 6, there he does reach a very different conclusion from Plato, because it's a sin to deny the sort of sacred soul from coming into being. I suppose the sort of the human life has a new secretness to it that wasn't necessarily there with Plato, right? There wasn't so much of a problem necessarily to let this go to waste. And so I suppose that is an important difference with the pagan. You know, the soul is somehow special because it's divine. And this is reinforced by this hierarchy he has where animals can't have these divine thoughts because their soul is lacking that extra sort of abstract element to it. I'm thinking as I go along here, but you know, obviously.
But the animals still have souls.
They still have souls, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
But they lack this extra quality to them.
So, I want to try to connect some things different people have been saying and see if we can draw in the literature types some more. So, part of this point I think in part was a minute ago was that how you conceive of the relation between soul and body will have a huge impact on how you understand immortality, or the possibility of immortality, and what immortality might be like, so that once your body is no longer alive, if you think that the soul or some part of the soul remains, it's going to have to be engaged in some activity that doesn't require the functions of the body, something like that. And then if you think it's an individual soul at that point, could it still rely on, say, sense perceptions you've had while alive? So, but if you, and I take it that if you're Christian, you want it to be an individual soul, and you want it to have some something it can do when separated from the body. But I want to, so this is just to say, when we talk about souls and we talk about, in particular, their connection with the body, one thing we're always talking about, at least implicitly, is the possibility of immortality and the nature of immortality, should it happen. But I want to return to Matteo's point about medicine, and because it seems to me one thing that's important about that, thinking of Ficino as the doctor of the soul, it, of course, to say that is to say this is a plastic thing, you know, your soul, and that is, you could alter it in certain ways. You could make it better and you could make it worse. It could get sick, and it could be improved. So this idea, too, that we don't have a particular place in ensouled beings so much as the possibility of assuming a place that, if not quite divine, is kind of pretty close to the divine, or if our souls get sick, if we don't care for our souls as we should, if we don't have Dr. Ficino around to help us, then we become much more like an animal. And that's a kind of, and I suppose in a very severe case, a plant.
And a stone would be the worst.
A stone would be the worst. Okay, yes, I think so. Although I don't think stones have souls, do they?
Yeah, but in terms of the chain of being.
Oh, yes, well, okay. But I was just thinking of something. But I also want to return to this question of practice, because it seems to me the medical business makes one reason to use that analogy. Right, is precisely to say the practices we assume, including embodied practices, might affect our souls, will affect, not just might, it's a little more strongly than that. So that the question of what practices we undertake, what habits we form, becomes really important if what you're worried about is the soul. So but I wanted to invite, having said that, Torrance to say something. When we were talking about doing this reading group, you said we really should try to bring together sort of the theoretical with the more practical. Now, obviously, we could speak theoretically about practices, but I do wonder if the people who do literature and do history and that have thoughts about concrete practices that one might recommend for the soul.
Ficino actually talks about practical things to do in order to align a soul and a body to the celestials. Yes. And it's on the third book, the Vita Celitus Comparanda. He talks about essence or quintessence, which is a substance and a soul at the same time trapped into physical things. And if we are able to ingest those things, they can help us through prayer to align our soul towards a specific celestial. So, ingest like wine or a specific fruits or food or a powder related to a specific kind of stone or mineral. For example, if I may quote, if you want your body, and spirit to receive power from some member of the cosmos, say from the sun, seek the things which above all are most solar amongst metals and gems, still more amongst plants, and more yet among animals, especially human beings,
Pursue things which are more similar to you, confer more of it. So you have to search for some more solar elements in order for you to align to a certain kind of soul.
This is really interesting because in some sense it's materiality. It's the corporeal that seems to have this possibility, this potency, as it were, to draw you to the object of amor. There's Giordano Bruno speaks of it as the link of this chain that connects you to. But it's not. I take it that in a way, it's just one way of kind of speaking this question of whether it is a turn of the back on corporeality or not. But it looks like, from that observation, that it's not. The corporeality has significance for the motion of love.
Yeah, especially as a vessel, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as a vessel.
Yes.
In order to communicate with our soul and align it. So, in my opinion, in Piccino, body has its own importance for as long as it's alive. I don't know about afterwards.
Yeah.
Presumably, it's because you have a sort of rational soul that you know that you should eat these things to make it even better, kind of thing.
But I think there's also the connection between not just healing the body, but healing the soul in order to heal the body.
Mm-hmm.
No, so in the 15th in Christian tradition, the idea that the soul can be sick and therefore it can have bodily manifestations is.
Yeah,
I mean, you find that already in the Bible, in the Gospels, when some people who are sick, argue by expelling the demons out of them. In the 15th, 16th century, the idea of doctor of the soul, as part of being doctor of the body. Remember, one of the first archbishops of Lima, one of the first things that he did was to found a city hospital, and he recommended reading and performing all kinds of rites, because in order to cure the bodies, not just because of conversion, but in order to cure the bodies, it's necessary to start by curing curing the soul. So the idea that being and particularly with what Mateo said, the idea that the Galenic tradition interacts also with the Christian medical tradition. Christian medical spiritual tradition, in Ficino, might be interesting.
Yeah, and if I can follow up on these, don't forget that in particularly on love, there is like a very old but still current in Ficino's time literature on love sickness, in the sense that in the Middle Ages, the viaticum of Constantine the African was sort of like widely circulating and pretty much presenting an idea of sort of like love that is. As this affection of the soul that could bring to madness, depression, and a state of melancholy.
Mm-hmm. And that influenced the humors and the
So it was Galenic application to psychology.
I want to pull Paul Hopkins into the discussion a little bit, because I'm sitting here thinking about the play that you guys put on during the summer, Midsummer Night's Dream, which is very much about desire and conversion, but also features a figure who becomes an animal. While he's an animal, he wants to eat hay, but the fairies insist on feeding much finer foods, nectar, refined, distilled foods. Now I have to go back to the text, which are products of the heat of the sun. And that's just a little tiny bit in this play that seems to, in some ways, to be playing with so much of the things we're talking about now.
I want to make sure we talk about conversion more. I thought, I didn't mean to cut things off now. So, but there's this one passage on page 108 in the readings. That's a kind of analogy. I'll show you. The Lodestone passage. Chapter 2 of Speech 6. So that there are actually two examples offered here. a lodestone puts into iron, a certain quality of its own by which the iron is first made like the lodestone and then drawn to it. And then fire also, to speak more openly, by its own quality, that is by heat, kindles flax, and the flax raised by the quality of heat flies up toward the upper region of fire. So I take it these are kind of images of desire when properly practiced, right? That, but I think these images suggest you've got to have your objects right, which is why I was insisting on.
Is it an appeal to a kind of Aristotelian conception of natural places, that in some sense certain bodies and certain elements have their proper places, and you could say that each of them is moved by desire to find its place. And as Pico goes on about, the human has a very ambiguous kind of relation to its natural place. It's confused about it, what its natural place is. But I think he seems to be implying that there is a natural place also for the human, and that should be in some sense the object of our quest.
Yes, the right place.
The right place.
But I'm also interested here that this suggests that the desire comes in part from the object that we desire. So the fire.
The object moves the.
Yes, yeah. The fire, which has to be God, right, and ultimately, is imparting heat to the flax. And the flax then, in virtue of being heated by the fire, becomes lighter, and that allows it to move closer. So there's. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of circuit that is, I think, a circuit of conversion, where something that holds attraction for us, so something that is a possible object of desire, affects those things that are capable of desiring in such a way that then their desire moves them more towards it. Now, these images suggest that this is all happening whether you like it or not, right? So the flax is not choosing to be heated by the fire. And I wondered also whether this suggests, so I want to connect this passage to the question about practice and whether we're supposed to put ourselves next to the right kinds of objects so that we could hope to be. I do think this connects to the sexual stuff.
Yeah, because he goes on about, I mean, it is slightly tangential, but he goes on about the problem of erections.
Yeah.
You know, even when you're contemplating something that shouldn't have to do with that, you know, sometimes, well, you know,
So there is a question, it seems to me, about desire. When we talk about the soul and its capacity for desire, whether desire, it might be aroused by an object of intellectual beauty, it might be aroused by an object of visual beauty, it might be aroused by some wonderful taste. But all of these things are affecting our souls, and I mean that in a technical sense, like altering our souls in some important way. So there's a kind of conversion in every little tiny act of desire that's going on. But the habits, as practices that are habitual, then become really important. Insofar as, although our souls are plastic and can be changed in all kinds of ways, the practices will form them, right? In some, so they're not. It can't be that there's never a stable state, I take it, of our souls, even while granting the point about them being malleable.
Definitely, and I think it was sort of like rooted in the history of sort of like Plato's commentaries. It shouldn't be forgotten that Ficino was an avid reader of Iamblichus. And so he has a ritualistic view of what even philosophy is, in the sense that there are documents. Aceto, for example, is a late member of the Florentine Academy, who describes sort of like what a class of philosophy performed by Ficino would look like. And, you know, he's describing sort of like Ficino wearing sort of like a solar amulet, was embracing the lyre of reciting Orphic hymns to eternity, and sort of like rising the souls of his listener to sort of like a contemplation. So the way he operated was bit different from what we can imagine, sort of like a classical philosophy looks like. You know? So, and the ritual, sort of like action and things where images and amulets and things like that, play a crucial role in his idea of what are the things you have to do in order to trigger epistrophe, sort of like the conversion and so on. And that's something that he gets from Iamblichus. Nobody before Ficino, Iamblichus had been forgotten for centuries, and Ficino translated the Mysteries. And still nowadays we read Iamblichus' works, which was transmitted without a title, as On the Mysteries, because it was the title that Ficino used. Yeah. And what he means by mystery is actually interesting. It comes in the English work today. Mm-hmm. But he has a ritualistic idea of sort of like a process of conversion.
But the fact of that difference doesn't come also from medieval astrology. I mean, from medieval astrological practices. I don't know, I mean...
Now, there are some scholars, especially like Wouter, Hanegraaff, von Stuckrad, like historians of religion who are working on Ficino, that link some of Ficino's ritualistic ideas with what is known as the clerical underworld, which was a certain sort of like a magic tradition that was transmitted by monks throughout the Middle Ages. The scholar of the sort of like this tradition is Fenger. And I don't know enough about it, but there are manuscripts that transmitted sort of like things to do, some strange far-fetched ritual that had spiritual benefits, but involved the use of sort of like ceremonial garments and objects and things like that. And that stuff was circulated.
So it's obviously all a ritual.
Yeah, it's interesting because Ficino's sort of like ideas on even ritual and ceremony is what is a theology, but the Anglican rituals happened in a time when there was actually a discussion going on about the ceremonies or sort of like the proper ritual to use, etc. So he has a very strange sort of like set of things to say on the subject. The best, you know, it's material that is relevant if you are into the history of Western esotericism rather than history of philosophy, so I would prefer to leave it aside.